The old man sat on a metal bar stool at the edge of the warehouse. Dust floated in the beam of light from holes near the roofline where rat doves, which were neither rats nor doves, had chewed their way through to shelter. Agnet stood beside him, shifting her weight from one foot to the other, a pistol in her hand. The old man was watching and rewatching video from the official government newsfeed. The poor asshole kneeling on the platform, mouthing some words, then the governor nodding like an old Roman emperor giving the thumbs down, and the executioner putting a bullet through the prisoner's skull. Every time the gun fired, the old man laughed. It wasn't mirth, it was derision. "This man," the old man said, tapping the frozen image of Governor Rittenhauer, "is fucking hilarious." "He just killed one of his own men to make a point," Agnet said. "Right? You know who does that shit? Theater majors," he said. Then, seeing her expression, he put the hand terminal in his pocket. "It's easy to execute your own. Someone that follows your orders, they're easy to kill. This, we hold ourselves to an exacting standard thing? I've seen it before. It's showy because who does that shit? But it's easy."
"I don't know, boss. It made an impression," she said. In the distance, the whine of an electric motor and the clash of the steel fence rolling open. The old man heard it and rose from his stool.
"Well, it shouldn't have," he said, walking toward the loading dock. "We're sure they were fighting, him and his wife?"
Agnet shrugged. She didn't like the way the boss thought about two things at once. It made her feel like he wasn't concentrating on the business at hand. "They were yelling at each other," she said. "Your friend in housekeeping couldn't make out all of what they were saying."
"Interesting. Our guy didn't want money, so maybe he's not greedy. But if he and the sweetheart aren't getting along, maybe there's an itch we can scratch there."
"Honeypot?"
"There's a reason the classics are classic."
"I'm on it," Agnet said. "But after we're done here." The loading dock door hummed for a second, warming up, then clattered as it rose. Dust and translucent scales came down into the light. The truck was old and rusting. The logo of a grain hauling company that had gone bankrupt 4 years earlier still peeled on its side. The back of the truck opened, and four men came out. All of them carried guns. The old man sniffed, cleared his throat, sneezed.
"Bless you," one of the four men said, the leader.
"Thanks," the old man said. The new man waited, motionless.
Agnet tightened her grip on the gun, but didn't raise it. For a long breath, no one moved.
"If this is the delivery," the old man said, "maybe you could deliver it? If it's something else..."
Bless you shook his head.
"It's the delivery, but the price has gone up."
"Disappointing," the old man said, but amiably.
"How much?"
"Doubled."
"Nope," the old man said. "Too greedy. Try again."
Bless you raised his gun, and the old man's titanium arm moved too quickly for the eye to follow. The deafening report of the gunshot almost drowned out the metallic sound of the bullet impact. The thugs were quiet, as if they'd been stunned by their own violence.
"Boss,"
Agnet said. The old man had his real hand pressed to his chest, pain in his features. His false arm reached out before him and opened its closed fist. The bullet dropped to the warehouse floor with a sharp tick.
"You boys," the old man said, enunciating each word clearly, "just fucked all the way up."
"Hey, Eric," bless you, started to say, fear in his voice. An apology? Whatever it was, he never got to finish. High in the rafters, the turret emplacement had heard the old man give the go phrase. The warehouse went bright with the stutter of its muzzle flash. The four men fell together. The staccato roar of the gun echoed through the warehouse space and then faded, leaving only a high-pitched whine in Agnet's ears.
"You all right?" she asked. Her voice sounded faint and distant.
She opened and closed her jaw a few times to make the ringing in her head go away.
Yeah, yeah, the old man said. I just hate it when the arm does that. Feels like the fucking thing's about to rip loose every time.
One of these days it will. She walked to where the men were writhing in the guano and dust on the warehouse floor. Flechette rounds had ripped bright red holes in their skin. The electrical smell of the shock rounds mixed with charred skin like roasting pig. This was how the old man worked. Everyone had been looking at Agnet and her pistol, thinking she was the muscle. It had made them overconfident.
You see, the old man said, not to the fallen thug, but to Agnet, this is the difference. A buy goes bad, and I need to send a message that that's not okay. I could go the Laconian way, right? Kill you and send these fuckers home. Would that make any sense?
I guess not, she said.
Grandstanding, the old man said, his false hand wrapping fingers around Blessu's throat. It's immature, is what it is.
Blessu tried to say something. Before he could, the old man used him to send a message. Self-rule for them, not for us. Mona knew enough about psychology to put her feelings in context. As Veronica sat across the table from Mona, shifting the display between the reports, breaking down the datasets into digestible summaries, and giving an overview of where the lab stood with the active experiments, Mona knew intellectually that the woman's voice wasn't really all that grating. Veronica's habit of interrupting herself and never quite getting back to the first sentence wasn't all that rare a quirk. Her haircut didn't really make her look like she was wearing a respectable administrator costume. Those were all artifacts of Mona's own state of mind. The knowledge didn't help. We're expecting to see some data from the photosynthesis study at Northfield by the end of the week, Veronica said. The preliminary report is, as you can tell, looking pretty good. She had to know, Mona thought. There was no way that the tension and antipathy were going under Veronica's radar. The smile was just the same as it had always been. The solicitous manner, the ready facts and reports. The woman had to know that Mona loathed her. But there was no sign of it. So either Mona was very good at hiding her emotions, or Veronica was. What about the microbiota compatibility studies? Mona asked. Veronica shook her head as she spoke. Those aren't in Northfield. Balakrishnan's work group is all in the old facility. I mean, nothing's really old around here, right? We've only been on the planet for a couple decades. You're changing the subject, Mona thought. Making Veronica Dietz uncomfortable was one of the few real pleasures in her day. When do we expect results from Balakrishnan's study? She asked. I think the next assay starts in about a month, but I'm not 100% on that, Veronica said. I can check if you want. And tell me whatever is most convenient for you, Mona thought. If Balakrishnan's results needed to be a failure to keep Veronica's skimming unnoticed, Mona had no doubt that the study would mysteriously fail. Just the way Dr. Carmichael's array translation study had become less promising when this woman, this snake, this parasite, didn't get a piece of it. Take a look for me, Mona said, standing up. We can go over it in 5? All right, Veronica said, as if the request were perfectly reasonable. Prepare a report in the time it takes to brew a cup of tea. Mona waited as Veronica walked out. She wouldn't leave the woman in her office alone, and then locked the office door behind her and headed right along the pale green hall and then right again into the commissary. She poured herself a cup of green tea and picked up a sugar cookie from the dessert table before sitting down alone at a table by the window. Tall white clouds rose on the horizon, glowing gold and red in the sunlight. She scowled at them. Someone had cracked the window open, and the breeze actually smelled fresh. She'd become so desensitized to the local environment that the fecal smell of the planet's biology didn't even register to her anymore. The situation with Veronica was becoming a problem, and not just because Veronica was a problem. Mona was meant to be reporting back to Laconia. There was a whole team of soil researchers and agricultural biologists waiting for her to share the insights of Shi Tam Yan and Oberon. There had even been queries from Dr. Cortázar, which was one step short of attention from Winston Duarte himself. She should have had a preliminary report ready to go, outlining the state of play not only for research here, but across the colony worlds that Oberon partnered with. Instead, she had notes on a criminal conspiracy, and a solemn injunction from Bir Yar that she should leave any action to the same regulatory bodies that had let it happen in the first place. The frustration was a restless energy in her spine. It was keeping her from focusing on her work. She had to get past it. She couldn't get past it. She kept remembering Dr. Carmichael at the reception her first night on Oberon. Her own excitement she'd felt when she heard about the array translation, the possibilities that a comprehensive mapping plan would give, not just here, but across all the colony systems, and the disbelief that anyone would intentionally undermine something with so much potential. It had been so recent, and yet that past version of herself already seemed so naive. Oberon was changing her, and she wasn't sure she liked what it was changing her into. She finished her cookie in a bite, gulped down the last of her tea, and headed back to her office. Not that she wanted to be there, just that the commissary was annoying her now, too. Or rather, that she was still annoyed, and nothing she'd found gave her any respite. Veronica hadn't returned with the report. Mona sat at her desk, looking sourly out her window. Same world, different view. Baradan spread out to her right. Streets and houses and domes. The local wilderness was on her left, exotic and untamed, and almost unimaginable in its diversity and richness and strangeness. This should have been everything she'd hoped for. All the pieces were there. Self-rule for them, her husband said in her memory. Not for us. But something shifted in the back of her mind. The thought came to her, fully formed, like she had already planned everything and had only been waiting for the right moment to be conscious of it. Point one. Either the administration of Shi Tam Yan was aware of Veronica's scheme, or their eyes were so thoroughly off the ball that it had been permitted by default. Two. As the spouse of the governor, she was more valuable to Shi Tam Yan than Veronica Dietz would ever be. 3. What was good for the goose might very well be quite excellent for the gander. She turned to her desk, a frown etching itself into her forehead almost hard enough to ache. She pulled up the financial records and tried to reallocate funds, just to make sure she couldn't. That was fine. Her breathing was shallow and fast, but when she made the connection request, her voice sounded calm. Dr. Rittenauer, an older man said from the screen. He had thin, gray hair and a little beard that didn't disguise his double chin. How can I help you? I'm having trouble with accounting. I need to allocate funds for a Laconian state project, but it gives me an error code. The man with the double chin looked chagrined. I'm not sure that... It should be under special projects, with a code for the Laconian Science Directorate? What would that be? I don't think we have a code set up for that, ma'am. We'll have to find something temporary, then. There is something for cooperative governmental programs, isn't there? We can use that for now. I guess you could, the man said. Not perfect, but... She shrugged and laughed. If you clear the access problem, I'll take care of it that way. She smiled patiently. She'd done nothing wrong. Not yet. If he pushed back, everything could be explained away. But she was the face of Laconia at Shi Tam Yan, and Laconia had just destroyed the largest navy in history and conquered the human race. She let the silence stretch. The man's face flushed a shade darker as he decided whether he was going to tell her she couldn't. He tapped something into his console.
"There you go, ma'am," he said. "It gives you any more trouble, just let me know."
Mona's smile widened by just a few millimeters. "Thank you," she said, and dropped the connection. After that, it was easy. She copied Dr. Carmichael's old funding structure and put it in a new branch under Joint Governmental Projects, updated the contact information so that any issues or questions routed directly to her. She was expecting the funding level to refer back to some pool of money, but it was just a text field. She could put in any value she liked, and the money was summoned from nothing. She put it in the value that Veronica's unspecified powers that be had refused. Then she doubled it and closed the file. Just like that, she'd funded the project that should have been going for months. She'd wait for a few days, make sure that no red flags came up, and then she'd tell Dr. Carmichael to start renting lab space and equipment. She sat back in her chair, folded her hands, and let out a long, satisfied sigh. There was a warmth in her chest, spreading slowly out toward her limbs like she'd just had a shot of gin. Her back relaxed. Her heart felt like she was dropping from orbit for the first time. Pleasure and risk. On impulse, she kicked her shoes off and ran her bare feet through the office carpet, feeling the texture of it against her skin. The soft knock came, and Veronica stepped in. "Sorry, that took a little longer than I'd thought. Interruptions all the time. You know how it is."
"Yes, I do," Mona said.
Bir Yar didn't know what changed in Mona, only that something had, and he was glad of it. He saw it in small things. She slept more deeply now, and woke without being prodded. She ate better, and explored more of the local foods, fish and onion, and a spicy red sauce the locals called Scharkensmirch. He'd sampled it himself, but found a metallic aftertaste he didn't care for. She was laughing more than she had, and there was an ease in the way she held herself. Her work with Shi Tamyan might have been part of it. She had started sending reports out to the researchers on Laconia, and the responses from home had been positive and encouraging. She'd begun negotiations for Laconia to get full datasets directly from the company and integrate some of its high-level researchers into the staff on Laconia proper. It was part of Duarte's long-term plan that coming to the capital should be a reward, a mark of favor. The soft power of culture and status would do more to stabilize Laconia's central position in the grand human project than any number of warships. It was good that Mona's position let her advance that. Bir Yar's own job wasn't going quite as smoothly. He hadn't found the trick yet of sleeping through the Oberon nights. Most nights he woke as the midnight sun fell, lying awake in their bed for half of the dark hours until morning. He'd considered talking to the physician about it. If it continued, he might. The local food also unsettled him, and he found himself eating the same diet he had on the Notus, mushroom curries and yeast-based cheeses. Even those didn't quite taste the way they should. He might not register the stink of the planet as often these days, but it had affected his senses all the same. And the pervasive sensation of unease, as vague as it was profound, wasn't helped by Overstreet security briefings. In the weeks since Laconia had officially taken over governance of the system, Overstreet had uncovered a dozen examples of embezzlement, theft, extortion, and financial misconduct just in the mechanisms of government that Bir Yar had inherited from the former head of state. Only two had involved Laconians. One had been the execution in the square. The other had killed himself when Overstreet's military police had come to arrest him. Everyone else had been turned over to local authorities. But Overstreet suspected that the judicial system was as flawed as the executive government. As the security audit broadened to the major businesses, the Transport Union, Shi Tamyan, Oesterling Biotics, and half a dozen more, Biryar expected more rot to come to light. The only good news Overstreet had to offer was the disappearance of the one-armed man. He hadn't appeared in any monitored public spaces. He hadn't shown up in any financial scans. If it hadn't been for the footage from the reception, he might only have been an unpleasant dream. Overstreet's analysis was that a local criminal had tried to come on strong, overplayed his hand, and fled when he understood the magnitude of his miscalculation. The reports coming in from other systems showed that the separatists were still very much at work. The governor of Nova Catalunya, a man Biryar had trained with, had died in a shuttle accident that was being investigated for sabotage. Governor Singh on Medina Station found another discrepancy in the station map that hid a service corridor, abandoned now, that the terrorists had used as they planned their missions. Drive plumes had been sighted in half a dozen systems that couldn't be tracked back to known ships. The ghosts of unrest were everywhere. The separatists couldn't stand in an open battle with Laconia, but they could resist in small ways, and those small ways could have body counts, too. He didn't bring his worries to Mona. Better that one of them should sleep well. If it felt a little strange not to tell her everything, at least the cause was noble. He still felt the urge now and then to unburden himself to her. He didn't have anyone else. Instead, he tried to keep his attention on his own duties, playing king-maker in local politics until Laconia was so established and unquestionable that he could play king. He found himself crafting the role of Governor Rittenhour as if he were acting a part in a play. He had come to notice when his own impulses were different from what Governor Rittenhour's would be, and then bury his own judgment to give space to the requirement of his office. He was a professional impersonator of himself. It required, among other things, a close relationship with the local news feeds. "I understand that the Notice is slated to leave Oberon," Lara Kasten said. She was a host for one of the popular public news feeds. Not a reporter, but a warm, approachable interviewer, whose greatest strength was the intensity with which she could listen. "It's already burning for the Ring Gate," he said. "It will still be weeks before it leaves the system, but yes, it's on its way." "That's got to feel a little odd." His office, decorated in the local style, had casual chairs set beside a window that looked out over a garden of earth plants. This was the fifth interview he'd granted her. It was important that the local population know him, normalize his presence. Lara's approach to their conversations suited his needs. "Not really," Biryar said, looking out at the red sunset of late morning, clouds on the eastern horizon already turning from gold to grey. "The Notice is a valuable resource and needed elsewhere. We have a great deal of work to do here, but Oberon doesn't need a warship. We're a very safe system. The situation is quite stable, and with the loyalty and cooperation of the authorities, I expect it will stay that way." Lara smiled and leaned forward to pick up a glass of iced tea. She took it with sugar. He knew that from the last time they'd talked. Previously, she'd worn a high-collared white blouse, but today she had one in Laconian blue with a scoop. Instead of returning the glass to the side table, she leaned forward and put it by her feet. He was careful not to notice the tops of her breasts as she did it. "But it was your way home, wasn't it?" she said. "Even if you never intended to use it. You spent your whole life on Laconia?" "I did, but Oberon is my home now." "What's that like for you?" she asked, and he thought there was a real curiosity in the question. He saw himself for a moment through her eyes, the proverbial stranger in a strange land, given power and responsibility, and asked to be strong for his nation and the people over whom he ruled. "I'm happy to be here. I am. Oberon is a beautiful planet, and an important part of the Empire." He nodded to himself, silently approving his own answer. That was the right thing to say, and the right way to say it. Turn the question back to the system itself. Not him, but them. Good that when the locals look at him, they see themselves reflected. He waited for the next question, but Lara was quiet. The sky darkened, and the first stars came out. The little moon, halfway to full, glimmered. She tilted her head, the straight, honey-colored hair hiding one eye, an impish smile on her lips. Bir-Yar felt himself smiling back, and he chuckled when he spoke.
What?
You're happy to be here? That's all?
You're the most important man in this system. There are literally millions of people looking up to you. You're on a planet you didn't set foot on until it belonged to you. It must be hard? Intoxicating? What is it like for you, Bir-Yar?
He shook his head. The breeze from the window was warm against his cheek. Lara's eyes were locked on his. He found that he wanted to tell her. He wanted to spread out all the ways that being Governor Rittenhour of Oberon System was different from what he'd expected, even after his training. The displacement of being so far from everything he'd known, the unease of knowing that there were people who hated him, not for himself, but what he stood for. That wasn't what his duty required of him.
I can't imagine anyone's terribly interested in that, he said, and his voice sounded almost melancholy in his ears.
That was odd. He recentered himself and said, I am really very happy to be here. Lara's smile faded. The last red light of sunset caught the curve of her throat, and Bir-Yar felt the impulse to turn the office lights on. He also felt the impulse to leave them off. He didn't move. Her expression wasn't impish now. He remembered the time in their third interview when she'd told him about her brother's death, how sorrowful she'd been, how strong in her grief. Of all the people on this stinking world, he felt closer to Lara than to anyone that hadn't come on the notice with him. She knew him. She leaned forward again, this time reaching not for her drink, but her handheld. She held it up for him to see. The recording marked second after silent second. She turned it off and set it back down. What is this like for you? She said. He was silent for a moment, uncertain whether he was going to answer, however much he wanted to. It's... Bir-Yar was surprised to find a thickness in his throat. It's difficult, sometimes. She nodded. Acknowledgement and encouragement in the same single motion. Bir-Yar leaned toward her, his elbows on his knees, his hands clasped. I am trained for my duties as thoroughly as anyone could be, but knowing something intellectually or from simulations, it isn't the same. You feel alone, Lara said.
I do, in a way, Bir-Yar said. This is... off the record, of course.
Her smile was in shadows now, but he could make it out. Just between us, she said, and traced an X over her chest. Cross my heart. He felt something shift deep in his gut, like a relaxation of a fist held clenched so long that the letting go ached. He drew in a breath, held it, and as he exhaled, he sank.
It's... overwhelming. Not always, but sometimes. I feel like a splinter, and Oberon is festering around me, isolating me, trying to push me out. Her voice was soft, but not pitying. He couldn't have stood it if she pitied him.
That's terrible, Bir-Yar.
It is, and I don't know what to do about it.
For a moment, the only sounds were the ticking of the walls as they cooled in the darkness and the murmur of midday traffic in the distant streets. Lara shifted, and he found himself very aware of her presence, her physicality and solidity. Her hand touched his, and it felt like a rope to a drowning man. She moved close to him, and he had the weird impression that she was reaching for the pistol at his side, that she was going to take it from him to make some demonstration of a larger point. It was only when her lips touched his that his mind exploded in cold alarm. He stood up, backing away in the darkness of the room.
I'm sorry. No, I'm very sorry. I didn't... This is not...
He found his desk, pulled up his controls, and turned on the lights. The office flooded with the bright blue-yellow of the daytime. Lara knelt in the space between their chairs, looking up at him in surprise. Biryar wiped his hands on the sides of his jacket. His tongue felt like it wasn't responding the way it should, like he was having a stroke.
This is... He shook his head. We should finish the interview. This was very nice. I'm glad to have your friendship. Yes, we should finish the interview.
He pressed his lips shut to make himself stop talking. He sounded like an idiot. Lara rose to her feet. She wasn't blushing as much as he was. Biryar, I'm sorry, she said. It's just...
No, it's fine. Everything is fine. There won't be any repercussions.
Lara eased herself back into her chair, plucked her blouse straight. Biryar stepped closer, but didn't take his seat. His blood was still electric. What if someone had seen them? What was he going to say to Mona? Because he had to tell Mona. It would be a betrayal not to. He swallowed.
I didn't mean to spook you, Lara said.
I'm not spooked, he said. He meant to follow it up with, I'm married, but what came out was different.
I'm Laconian.
Lara quirked a smile, and he thought there was regret in it. She took her handheld, her finger hovering just above the button to start the recording again. Her eyes were asking if he was certain, but he was himself again, or no, he was Governor Rittenhour. That was better. She tapped the button, and the seconds began counting up again. Biryar put his hands on the back of his chair, pressing into it like it was a podium. He thought back to where the conversation had been.
I'm really very happy to be here, he said. Oberon is a fascinating planet with a great future before it. I hope that my service here will help it come into its rightful place as one of humanity's great centers of science and culture. And I know the High Council has the same ambitions for it.
He nodded sharply, more to himself than to her. That was the right answer. That was what he was supposed to say. Who he was supposed to be. Lara tilted her head. Do you want to sit down? The yacht was a small one, and the old man didn't like it much. In all the time Agnet had been with him, he had only used it 3 or 4 times that she knew of. He'd grown up in a coastal city, but she didn't have the impression there had been a lot of yachts involved. The fact that he was in it now meant he was running out of places to be that he was certain the local security forces weren't watching. He sat with his arms out at his sides. 2 days of stubble competed with his thin mustache. The sun was overhead, the light glimmering off the water and his false arm. He was smoking a cigar as thick as his thumb and as long as his finger. The city rose up at the horizon like a mirage. The woman sitting across from them had gone by Karkara when they'd first met her. It was Lara now, which suited her better. I swear to God I had him.
We shouldn't have rushed you, the old man said.
I didn't rush. I had him. We had rapport. We had shared jokes. He was into me.
And then?
Lara opened her hands. Then the moment came, and he backpedaled. I don't know. Clearly he and his wife have a monogamy agreement, and he's taking it seriously. Maybe that's a Laconian thing.
Did he say that?
No, it's a guess, Lara said. He was babbling by the end. Lots of words, but none of them meant anything.
What do you think of him?
She considered. Agnet could see from the way the woman held her hands that Lara almost liked the mark. There was nothing like being told no to make someone attractive. That man needs something, Lara said, and he needs it bad. But it's not what I was offering. The old man blew out a cloud of white smoke and watched the wind shred it.
That's what I think too. Is he maybe into guys?
That's not it, Lara said. I've met maybe one person in 20 who claims to be monogamous and actually is. I think this guy's really into his wife. The old man muttered something obscene. Then,
I don't get it. He's not looking for money. He's not looking for kink. What is it with this guy?
Lara said, I think he's looking for a way out.
Of what?
His own skin.
Well, I'm looking for a way not to take that literally, but this fucker does make it hard.
He looked out over the water. Something large and pale passed under them, but didn't break the surface. The old man sighed.
Maybe we should just kill him,
Agnet said. Why were they fighting? He shifted his head to look at her. Agnet met his gaze without flinching. He and his wife were fighting about something, and then they stopped. Maybe there's something in that. The old man weighed the idea while he took another puff on his cigar. His eyes shifted up to the sky, but he wasn't looking at anything. Or not anything that was there.
He have any friends?
Lara shook her head. None that he ever talked about. He doesn't do relationships with people. Just responsibilities to them.
So, just the wife then, as far as you know. Sex and friendship. That's a tough knot to unwind.
I think he really loves her, she said. Again, the little twitch of regret. They were going to have to be careful how they used her, moving forward. She was going to talk herself into falling in love with Rittenhauer if they took their eyes off her. The old man made a deep, soft sound, like satisfaction. The yacht bobbed on the waves.
I forget, you know? I just forget.
What, boss?
How complicated people are. How many kinds of hunger we're working with.
Not following you. The old man shrugged, and the fake arm almost matched the real one. The movement was still just a little asymmetrical. It made him seem jaunty.
There was a guy I knew back in Soul System used to say that money was like sex. You thought it would fix everything, until you got a lot of it. Because that's what we all reach for. Anything we need, anything we want, anything that's grinding us down, we can get high or rich or laid and make it better. Only if that was true, people would eventually get enough drugs or money or sex and be happy.
We'd be out of jobs, Agnet said.
But Rittenhauer,
the old man went on like she hadn't spoken,
this guy lives his whole life in this culture where it's about
duty, Lara said. So, Agnet said, the way a normal person tries to get out of the hole by putting a needle in their arm or fucking a pretty body or working 100 hours a week, he tries to get out by being a good man. She said the words slowly to see if they sounded true.
Only it doesn't work for him any better than that other shit does for the rest of us,
the old man said. Then, a moment later,
look at the wife. If he loves her as much as Lara thinks, she's the weak spot.
What am I looking for? Agnet asked.
Whatever's there. Every addict has to hit bottom, the old man said. Maybe we can help him with that.
I'll see what I can do, Agnet said. I know it didn't exactly work, but... Lara hesitated, afraid to ask. Our thing? She was asking about the debt her attempted seduction was going to pay off.
How much did you owe us?
He asked. You know exactly how much, Lara replied.
Yeah, it's off the books now, the old man said. But stay out of my casinos. You're very bad at poker.
Business concluded, they watched the sun speed across the sky and dive for the horizon. The water was turning golden as they angled back for shore. The old man made them all steaks on the little range, the meat decanted fresh from the growth disc. When they got back to civilization, Agnet put her resources into the wife and Shi Tamyan Agricultural Concern, where she had offices. She wasn't looking for something in particular, an affair, an illegal drug habit, a second life, anything. Even so, it took her days to find it. Birjar didn't know what he had expected from Mona when he told her. Anger, perhaps, a sense of betrayal, a rupture in their marriage at least, an estrangement at worst. He had laid out all that had happened, the interviews, the connection that had been cultivated during them, and, with his heart in his throat, the kiss. Mona sat across the breakfast table from him, listening to every detail. Only at the end, when he outlined all the precautions he was putting in place to see that it never happened again, did a line of concern draw itself on her forehead. "She just stole a kiss?" Mona asked. "That's all?" "But I allowed myself to permit a sense of intimacy that made it possible," Birjar said. His eggs had grown cold and thick while he spoke. "This was my fault. It will never happen again." She'd taken his hand then, and when she spoke, there was a seriousness in her voice, so studied and careful that he suspected there was amusement behind it. "Thank you for treating me with respect. I mean that. But I'm not angry with you at all. Don't beat yourself up over this, all right?" He kissed her fingers, and the subject had never come up again. He went back to his duties with the relief of having dodged a bullet. He policed himself more harshly, wary of any other transgression. Birjar the man wasn't to be trusted. There was only room for Governor Rittenhour. So he tightened his control and pushed out anything besides duty and decorum. It was the only way. He attended meetings with Suyet Klinger of the Association of Worlds and approved the trade agreements for the transport union. He stood witness at another execution when Overstreet discovered a Laconian guard who had been extorting sexual favors from a local man. He made his reports to the political officer back on Laconia and received guidance that tracked back to Winston Duarte himself. That he couldn't sleep, that his food tasted strange and left his stomach upset, that the sunlight began to give him headaches, that he sometimes had the weird, oppressive sense of drowning at the bottom of an ocean of air, that was only his acclimation going slowly. A few more weeks, and he would be fine. He was sure of it. He was able to maintain the illusion that everything was under control until the day the one-armed man reappeared. The conference was in Carlisle. It was the third largest city on the planet, and fewer than 1 million people lived in it and the area around it. It was in a higher clime than Baradun, and in the northern hemisphere where the seasonal shift made the air cold and the daylight period slightly briefer. The trees were similar to the ones in Baradun, but with the cold weather they had shriveled, wrinkled, and gone limp. The dark trunks bent toward the stony ground. The reception and Birjar's speech had been planned for a courtyard in the center of the mayoral complex, but a storm changed direction as Birjar's transport left Baradun, and a cold and bitter rain was pelting down from low clouds when he arrived. As his liaison rushed him from his transport into the mayoral complex, Birjar sniffed the air, hoping to find some hint of the minty smell of wet Laconian soil. Rain on Oberon smelled like nothing, or it smelled like an open sewer, and he couldn't tell any longer, one or the other. The liaison apologized his way down the wide, pale hallway. The change in the weather had come with no warning. They hadn't thought they would need to shift to the secondary venue, a public theater just across from the complex, until the last moment. It would only take them a little time to have it ready and the audience of local business and government leaders taken there. Birjar swallowed his annoyance and made himself as gracious as he imagined Duarte would have been in his place. The waiting area belonged to the mayor herself, part of her private apartment. If he would make himself at home and be comfortable. In fairness, the waiting room was pleasant enough. A wide glass window looked out over a vast, wild landscape. Rough, tooth-like mountains rose above the city, halfway lost in the gray of the storm. The rain that struck the window froze there for a moment, then melted and dripped down. When the clouds finally cleared, the landscape would be encased in ice. Ice like a second skin. Ice like a shroud. His speech was on the importance of maintaining robust trade with the other systems and Laconia's commitment to keeping the economy of Oberon strong. He knew it by heart. Instead of reviewing it again, he sat on the little couch and looked out at the weather. The door opened behind him, and a man in a crisp white jacket and matching gloves came in, carrying a tray with a thermos of coffee, two cups, and a plate of pastries. "Put them on the table here," Birjar said. "I can serve myself."
"You know, Governor," the old man said as he placed the thermos and cups on the table at Birjar's side, "I have got to give it to your security people. I've been trying to see you for a while now, and they've got your place buttoned up tighter than a horsefly's asshole."
The old man smiled. Even before Birjar registered the glint of metal between the man's cuff and his glove, he remembered the thin mustache. "He's come to kill me," Birjar thought, and a thrill ran through him. He felt the weight of the sidearm on his hip, even as he sensed that a gun probably wasn't going to help. He knew enough killers to know that he wasn't one, and that the man facing him was. He nodded solemnly. "I was wondering if I'd see you again. You've been hard to find as well." The one-armed man sat down across from him and spoke as he plucked off his gloves.
"Well, I was worried that we'd gotten off on the wrong foot. That's my fault. I come on a little strong sometimes. You want some coffee?"
"Cream, please," Birjar said. His heart was tapping against his ribs like it was desperate for his attention. He let his hand casually drift toward his hip. The one-armed man's voice was harder.
"If you pull that gun, it'll mean we're having the worst version of this conversation. Honest to Pete, you'll wish you hadn't. No sweetener?"
"No," Birjar said. He let his hand drop to the sofa, near his holster, but motionless. It was dangerous to move forward, but he wasn't going to give up ground either. He imagined pulling the gun and firing. How quickly could he do that? How long could it take? The rest of his life, maybe.
"Just cream."
"Good choice. I like it black, myself. The older I get, the more bitter shit suits me. You ever feel like that?"
"Sometimes," Birjar said. The man held out a coffee cup on a saucer, and Birjar nodded toward the table. He wouldn't take it. The old man was holding it with his prosthetic hand. How fast was the mechanism? What weapons were concealed in it? It was like watching a snake that he knew was venomous, and wondering how long a bite would take to stop his breath.
"What can I do for you?" Birjar said, trying desperately to make the words sound casual, as if he were in control. "Or are you here to make good on your threat?"
"Nah, we're past that. But I am here on business, as it were," the man said, putting the coffee cup down on the table. "I have something for you. Kind of a peace offering."
"I didn't know peace was an option between us. I was hoping to have you tried, sentenced, and executed."
The provocation struck home. The man smoothed his mustache. Birjar knew he shouldn't have said it, but the fear was shifting in him, turning to something like courage, or anger, or a mad, dark, rushing hope that Birjar didn't wholly understand.
"I get that. But let me ask you something. Hypothetically, there's someone in your organization, Laconian, not one of ours. Let's say they're making up projects in your name, using them to falsify work orders, fudging the budget. That's a problem for you, right?"
"You know the answer to that."
"I do, but I'd like to hear you say it just the same, if it's not a problem."
The one-armed man looked distracted by the conversation.
A few centimeters would put his hand on the pistol. The angle made it awkward to draw. Biryar shifted his weight a little to make it easier, and the one-armed man shook his head like he was reading his mind.
"Misappropriation of Laconian funds is at best larceny, at worst treason," Biryar said. "One is a prison sentence, the other is death."
"What about a governor's pardon? You can do that, right?"
"No Laconian is above the law," Biryar said. "That is what discipline means."
"That's what I thought," the old man said,
his eyes locked on Biryar's as he drew a handheld from his pocket.
"For what it's worth, I am sorry about this."
He held it out. Biryar's gaze flickered down to it, and then back up, ready for the attack. It took a few seconds for what he'd seen to register. Mona Rittenauer. Almost against his will, his eyes drifted back down. The old man kept holding it out, and this time, Biryar took it. The financial records were marked as Shi Tamyan, and the spreadsheet listed Mona's name, and monetary amounts, budget levels and outflows. There were other names, and one rang a bell. Carmichael, the woman whose research had been unfairly cancelled, the one they'd fought over. The one-armed man forgotten, he shifted through the files. Mona's name was highlighted, and the words "cooperative government programs." If programs like that existed, he would have known about them. He would have had to approve them. He hadn't. The storm had grown worse, the wind so terrible it was shaking the building itself, making the walls shudder. Only it wasn't any louder, and the beige surface of the coffee was smooth and still. Something else was shaking. Biryar put down the handheld.
"What do you want from me?"
"Nothing," the man said. "I'm just letting you know that one of your own stepped a little off the path."
"Blackmail?"
"For blackmail, you need an ask. I don't want anything from you. I have this information. I'm giving it to you. That's all. I'm being the good guy here."
And now, it was his duty to tell what he'd learned to Major Overstreet. And it would be Overstreet's duty to arrest Mona. Biryar would have to recuse himself, so they'd send her back to Laconia for trial. His Mona, the woman whose fingers he kissed in the morning. He tried to imagine what it would feel like to see her sent to the pens. It was like trying to imagine being dead. Or he could hide the information, make her scrub away all sign of it, cancel the projects, erase the financial trail that led to her. Then, when Overstreet found them, they would die together. His sternum ached like he'd been punched there. Everything under it was hollow. He could hardly draw a breath. It was perfect. Even if he could pull his pistol and shoot the one-armed man dead, there was still a bullet coming for him. Worse, it was coming from Mona, and there was no way to stop it. He couldn't even die to protect her. He tried to move, but he was made from clay. He saw sympathy in the other man's eyes.
"Truth is, if Shi Tamyan found out about this, they'd probably praise her initiative and give her a raise. Those guys just do business that way. But she's one of yours, so..."
"Discipline," Biryar said. There was no way out. The end of his world had come. There was nothing to do but welcome it. It wasn't a thought. It wasn't considered. Like water moving down, it was simply the way things worked. The way they had to be. Natural. Biryar drew the pistol, lifted it to his head, and pulled the trigger. The old man's eyes barely had time to widen. His false arm, though, had a mind of its own, and it was faster than either of theirs. Before the trigger came back a full millimeter, the gun wrenched away. The old man cried out, clutching his real hand to his chest. The metal hand held Biryar's pistol, its barrel visibly bent.
Jesus fuck, but I hate when it does that, the old man said.
Then, with heat,
fuck is wrong with you, kid?
Biryar didn't answer. He wasn't there. Governor Rittenhour, the voice and face of Winston Duarte, didn't make sense here, and without him, Biryar was like a vine whose trellis had collapsed. He had no form, no structure. He couldn't even die. The one-armed man put the ruined pistol on the table, picked up Biryar's cup of coffee, and sipped from it.
Okay, I get it.
I can't lose her, Biryar said. I can't stay with her, and I can't lose her. What else is there to do?
They really do a fucking job on you people, don't they?
The one-armed man said. Then, after a long moment, he sighed.
Listen to me. I didn't lose my arm in a fight or anything. I was born wrong. Something about not enough blood flow, stunted development, whatever. It was like a skinny little baby arm. Mostly, I just kind of curled it up against my chest here and forgot about it. I did fine. It was nothing big. I kept meaning to get it seen to, you know, take it off and regrow it from gel. But one thing and another, I just never seemed to get around to it. You know what I mean? People would give me shit and I'd laugh and say how, yeah, it would be a good idea, but I didn't do it. Then maybe 15 years ago,
he raised his metal hand, rotating it in the light.
This, the old man said, it's fucking badass. Basically a built-in Waldo with virtual intelligence and pattern matching. It's not networked, so it's unhackable. And it's strong as shit. Bends steel. Stops bullets. You know what else it does? Plays piano. No shit. I can't, but it can.
It's very nice, Biryar said.
You're young yet. I'm not. There's this thing when you get older where you have to make a choice. Everyone does. You have to decide whether you care more about being your best self or your real one. If you're more loyal to who you ought to be or who you really are. You know what I'm talking about?
Biryar nodded. He was weeping.
Yeah, the old man said. I thought you might. I'm gonna tell you a secret. I've never told anyone this, not my girlfriends, not my closest allies. No one. You listening to me?
Biryar nodded again.
I miss my real fucking arm, the old man said. I liked it better when I was me.
Biryar sobbed, and it sounded like a cough.
I don't want anything from you, Governor, but I would ask you this. Looking at where you are now and the choices you've got, is there anything you maybe want from me?
The wind howled, threw a handful of hail at the window. Biryar barely heard it.
You can't make this go away, he said. Overstreet will find it. He'll know. He will, the old man said. You know, if.
They were quiet. Biryar felt something happening in him, something he both didn't recognize and also knew as well as the sound of his own voice.
Could you have done it? Could you have killed me? Yeah, the old man said. Half a dozen times, easy. But it would have been a risk. I don't get to pick your replacement, right? Think about this Overstreet fella. He's not on his home pitch. If something happened to him, maybe it'd be a good idea to put together some locals to take over the security jobs. People who know the lay of the land, how things work here.
If something happened to him?
Yeah, if, the old man said. And then, do you want it to?
Biryar breathed.
Yes.
The one-armed man relaxed and stood up. He put on his gloves again. Looked out at the sleet and rain and hail, the half-hidden mountains.
This isn't just you.
What?
Don't feel bad, because it ain't just you, the one-armed man said with a lopsided shrug. There are, what, a couple hundred decent-sized colony worlds with shiny new Laconian governors on them? And this thing has, or is going to happen, on every single one. It's the basic problem with religion, be it Jesus or Vishnu or God emperors. Ideological purity never survives contact with the enemy.
I don't, Biryar started.
Yeah, you do, the one-armed man said,
then stepped out and closed the door behind him. Biryar sat for a moment, waiting for the guilt and horror to come, for his conscience to overwhelm him. Half a planet away, Major Overstreet was probably just waking up. There was time to call him, to warn him. Mona was waking up too, in their bed. Biryar took a long breath and let it out through his teeth. He felt something deep and profound, but he didn't know what he felt. It was too big to judge. The liaison came in, and Biryar tucked the handheld in his pocket. The liaison's eyes widened at the pistol, but Biryar pretended not to notice that it was there. They walked together across a covered bridge and into the theater where his audience was waiting. Mona felt the hair on the back of her neck go up the moment she stepped into her house and found Veronica Dietz waiting in the parlor. It had been a long day that followed a restless night. Biryar had been in Carlisle, and she never slept as well when he wasn't on the other half of the bed. She'd wanted nothing more than to come home, take off her shoes, drink some wine, and relax. Finding Veronica lying in wait was like feeling a snake move in her pillowcase. Veronica, she said, feigning pleasure. Yes, ma'am, Veronica said, and then stopped. It was like she was waiting for Mona to say something. The moment stretched. I wasn't expecting to see you here, Mona said carefully. Veronica blinked, confused. Oh, she said, I had a request from the governor's office. I thought, that is, I assumed that you... I'm sorry, Biryar said, coming into the room. That was me. He took Mona's hand, squeezed it gently, and kissed her fingers. I missed you. I'm glad you're back, Mona said. Something was wrong, or if not wrong, at least very different. She didn't understand what was happening, except that Biryar was ushering them both to sofas and motioning them to sit. How was Carlisle? Fine. It was fine. I had some time to think, and I wanted you both here. Mona felt a stab of fear, but she took a seat. Veronica lowered herself into a chair. What's this about, dear? Mona asked. It's important that Oberon and Laconia be very much coordinated. In the sciences, Biryar said. There was something very odd about the way he spoke. He seemed looser, calmer, maybe a little melancholy. That might have been more alarming than Veronica's presence. So I've taken the liberty of requesting a placement at the Science Directorate in the capital, and I've recommended Ms. Dietz for the position. Transport will be entirely taken care of. Your housing will be in the university complex with some of the best minds in the empire. Shi Tamyan has already been informed. Veronica's mouth was open. Her face was pale. Mona felt like she'd been spun too long on a swing. She didn't understand what Biryar was thinking. And then she did. Her living expenses, Mona said. All overseen by Laconia, Biryar said. Everything will be overseen by Laconia. I can't do that, Veronica said, and her voice was tight. That's very kind of you, that's... But I have so much here that I can't really... Biryar raised a hand, and his voice went quiet. Quiet, but not soft. Ms. Dietz, it is critical to the success of this colony that you understand what Laconian culture and discipline are, just as we learn what it is to be from Oberon. You will accept this position, and you will take the honor seriously. We will be treating you as one of our own." Veronica seemed to be having a little trouble breathing. Mona felt something equal parts joy and vindictiveness brighten her heart. She thought she saw Biryar glance at her, a smile ghosting on his lips, but it was gone before she could be certain. His handheld chimed, and he looked at it before refusing the connection. When he looked back up, he was somber. He stood and drew Veronica to standing. "This position could change your life," he said. "I don't know what to say," she said. "You're welcome," Biryar said, and escorted her to the door. "Please, don't mention it. I hope you won't think I'm rude, but..." "No," she said. "No, of course." "Good," he said, and closed the door behind her. When they were alone, he seemed to sag into his bones, all his muscles gone slack. He turned back to her and smiled sheepishly. Mona shook her head. "Are you all right?"
"Yes. No. I don't know. I feel like I'm smiling more often," Biryar said as he came back and sat beside her.
He rested his head on her shoulder the way he had when they were first courting. It made him seem younger.
"Next time, let me approve it. It's safer that way."
She was about to say, "Approve what?" But the question would have been a lie. He knew, and she knew that he did. Instead, she said, "I will." His handheld chimed again. She caught a glimpse of it as he silenced it. The red band of a high security alert. An emergency. He took her hand, lacing his fingers in among hers. "Who's that from?" she asked.
"Overstreet's office," Biryar said. "I'll get back to them. It's nothing that won't wait a few minutes."
She shifted to look him in the eyes. He was serene. He was grieving. He was himself in a way she hadn't seen in months. "What happened?" she whispered. She felt him shrug. She watched him look into her.
"I've committed to the process," he said.
The handheld chimed again. This has been a Hachette audio production of Oberon, an Expanse novella. Written by James S.A. Corey. Read by Jefferson Mays. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Post-production by Sean Bolter and Mike Sandoval. Production supervised by Elise Green. Oberon is also available in ebook format from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by James S.A. Corey. Audio production copyright 2019 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this group without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.